This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 167 was recorded on May 23rd, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Invesco Chief Economist John Greenwood joins me as this week's feature interview guest. Unlike several of our other recent guests, John thinks we're midway through the business cycle and that once the current turbulence is over, stocks are set to move higher. We're getting rave reviews on our new expanded content, and we plan to keep bringing you new content every single trading day. The third episode of Energy Week aired yesterday, and we also aired All-Stars appearances featuring Juliette DeClercq and Professor Steve Keen this week. Kevin Muir's All-Star appearance airs Friday morning. And be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when Patrick has prepared another of his famous chart books, this time looking at the pattern in commodities, including crude oil, which took a major dive today.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 had a pretty strong sell day today. At one point, we were down almost 50 points. What's your thinking here on the S&P?
You know, when all of this started, Patrick, it was all about China and the trade wars. And that's still a major driver, to be sure. That's one of the reasons that things are falling apart today. But I think the bond market is telling us that the macro environment is souring and souring fast. And I think that what's going on is almost everybody is thinking, okay, this is all about China because that's what the headline has been. I think the market's figuring out there's more to this than just the China deal. And I think that maybe that exuberance, the irrational exuberance that was in the marketplace, you know, it feels like the sentiment is finally coming a little bit more in line with economic reality, or at least that's the way it feels to me after the last couple of days. Clearly, though, China and China relations have been the proximal catalyst for the current move. 2800 is the major support level to watch immediately. 2600 is the next major level to watch. My predictions here, I think at some point, some sort of China deal will eventually materialize, but I wouldn't be surprised if it takes longer than most people expect. Asian culture thing, Asians are generally much more patient than Westerners in taking their time to negotiate a deal. So I won't be at all surprised if China is willing to drag this out as long as necessary in order to try to negotiate their position. So I won't be surprised if Jay Powell and the FOMC have to intervene to rescue markets before we get there. Now, if we see that intervention in the markets, it to me is going to be just incredibly important to watch how accommodative Powell is and how he handles himself. If it's just a, okay, well, we said we weren't really going to defend markets, but we lied. We really are. And, you know, okay, the Fed put is alive and well. It sets up more exuberance, but, you know, where does it ultimately lead? I think that what's more likely is that Powell is going to be trying to walk that very difficult balancing act between not wanting to appear like he's in the business of accommodating markets, even though to some extent he really is. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see more of a downside fit and then eventually a China deal. Once we get a China deal, it might be too late. We might have gotten to the point where the sentiment has shifted and people have figured out that there's plenty of reasons far more important than China trade relations to be bearish about this market. But at the moment, I think everybody's focused on China. So we really need to watch how the Fed responds if things get softer. And it seems like if today was any indication, softer times may be ahead.
All right. Well, let's move on to that US dollar index, because earlier this morning, we had the dollar poking above those April highs. And I was had my attention seeing whether or not that was going to break out. And well, it's at least come back off of that high. What's your thinking here on the dollar?
Patrick, this really has my close attention, and here's the reason why. First of all, as I've said for many weeks on this program, my fundamental view has been bullish. I think we're right on the hairy edge of a major breakout, and that when we do see a daily close above 98, 98.5, it's going to get more buying, and there's going to be price acceleration on heavy volume, which is the confirmation signal we need to see that this rally is really taken off. The thing is, as much as every time I revisit the fundamentals, I still come to that same conclusion. If I look at the tape, there have been a few times now where we saw the beginning of the breakout that we were waiting for, and it ended up happening intraday and just getting hammered back down so that by the daily close, we were back below the key level. And that's exactly what we saw today. This breakout in the morning looked super duper bullish while it lasted, all the way up to 98.25 or so. But now we're back down to 97.75 as of the 4 p.m. close. So each time, you know, as much as I'm saying that the market should be on the precipice or on the edge of a big upside breakout, it seems like each time we start to get one, it gets smashed back down. Those are the ingredients, Patrick, of a topping market, not a market that's on the edge of a breakout. Now, why would the market be topping here? Certainly, Simon White made that argument last week. I haven't agreed with Simon. I still don't on the fundamentals, but boy, this tape action is starting to concern me in terms of not really jibing with my fundamental view.
Well, let's move on to crude oil because, well, that was the biggest one-day move we had probably in months. And I'm certainly curious as to what you think is behind it.
Well, the big picture here is the sell-off in crude oil began at the end of April because the market was already overextended too high to the upside. That's my personal opinion. This last couple of weeks, this rally was all about Iran military risk. The smartest money knew it was coming before the public news was out. And of course, President Trump's tweet last weekend really sealed the deal. That puts people in panic buy mode. Gotta buy, gotta buy. Could be war coming. Everybody knows the price of oil goes up in a war. Oh my God, have to buy, have to buy, have to buy. And then eventually they calm down a little bit and say, hey, wait a minute. Why are we buying here? We know that if there is a war that disrupts global oil supply, that absolutely, with almost no limit, can cause prices to go radically higher. But Saudi Arabia is very strongly incented to increase production in order to make sure that the United States can do its dirty work for it and have a war with Saudi's biggest arch rival, Iran, without allowing oil prices to get in the way. So I really don't think, when you consider that Iranian sanctions have already caused the market to pretty much discount most of Iranian production out of the equation, I don't think there's a huge amount of downside in terms of oil market disruption as a result of a U.S.-Iranian military conflict. Now, anytime there's a military conflict in the Middle East, there's always a risk of escalation, and it could suddenly turn into something much bigger than the way it started. But if you look at just what's started so far, which is the risk of the United States taking military action against Iran, I think Saudi would love to see that so much that they will do anything possible, including helping President Trump to achieve lower oil prices. So we actually see prices go down through the course of an Iranian conflict as opposed to up. So I think that as that was coming out of the market, the prices were already selling off, but the market wanted to wait and see what inventory brought, and inventory brought very bearish news. Crude oil building 4.7 million barrels, great big build. Cushing building 1.3 million barrels. Gasoline building 3.7 million barrels. Distillates building 768,000 barrels. So builds across the board. Now we've got a market that was already looking for an excuse to go lower, and all of a sudden you hit it with a super bearish inventory report. Market goes straight down on that, with RBOB being the hardest hit, and it was no surprise seeing how hard it was hit yesterday. I said in the introduction to yesterday's Energy Week, okay, folks, we just closed below all the short-term moving moving averages. This looks like a signal that we're probably headed lower. And sure enough, we got that in spades today. U.S. production also ticked back up to 12.2 million barrels. Now, that's only 100,000 barrel tick up. But the point is, Patrick, we were concerned to watch whether there was a trend reversal in U.S. production growth. And seeing two consecutive downticks 2 weeks in a row kind of raised my eyebrows and thought, could this be a trend? Well, now we're moving the other direction. It's only one tick in the other direction. But the point is, we're not seeing an accelerating trend. Imports, 6.9 million barrels. Exports down this week to 2.9 million barrels, or just over 20 million barrels on the week. Of course, there is no limit to upside potential if there is a geopolitical upset that truly threatens global oil supply. But I don't think that this U.S.-Iran situation really meets those criteria. In the absence of a geopolitical threat, I think that today's action probably signals we're headed lower, maybe a lot lower, back into the 40s or even retesting the low that we saw on Christmas. But the thing is, Patrick, we saw such a sudden sell-off today. The five-day gap between the five-day moving average and the market price is way too wide. We left, I count, 10 separate repair levels that were left open today and yesterday on the TPO chart for West Texas crude oil. So there's all kinds of levels above the market that we should expect a retrace to. I'm already short this market. I want to add to my short position as we move up higher. And frankly, it's hard to choose what level or what target you think we're going to retrace to. We've got to have some kind of a bounce. This was a huge move today. But if you look at the fact that we closed below the 100-day moving average, couldn't even get that number back before the close, it really portends a lot of downside left to come. So how big of a bounce should we expect? That really is the operative question.
All right. Well, let's move on to gold because, well, I mean, it certainly has not been selling, at least not today. We're up $10 off of the lows. What's your thinking here on gold?
You know, I'm tempted to short it here. It's not doing quite what I expected, though. What I thought was going to happen is that we were going to close below the trend line. This is what I said last week. And that daily close moving back below the trend line, proving that the previous breakout was a false breakout, I thought that was going to be a bearish signal that would take the market much lower. And of course, the geopolitical escalations ratcheted back up before that could happen. So in the last 2 days, we've taken out that trend line again. But this time, when we took out the trend line, it's a downsloping trend line. In terms of the level that we hit, it's much lower than we hit last time. So we're pulling out of the established channel, but only by a little bit. And last time it reversed lower. And I think that this geopolitical fear is going to de-escalate eventually. So it's tempting to short here. I certainly think that if there's an escalation of geopolitical tension, or if there's other fundamentals that drive gold higher, if you saw a move above 1350, which is well above the current market, that would really be an indication to me, okay, it's really time to admit I was wrong and just get on the long trade on gold. But until we see that break above 1350, I'm waiting for the geopolitics to calm down so that that fear comes out of the market, and I think gold will move lower and the dollar will move higher. If I'm wrong about the dollar and the dollar is topping here, which I do see a couple of technical signs of in the chart, although I don't see it in the fundamentals, that would be a good case for gold to move higher. So I'm not going to short it here, as tempting as that is, but I think probably we're about to move back into the channel.
Let's move on to that 10-year Treasury yield, because not only did we take out that April low, making it the low of 2019, we haven't seen this low yield on the 10-year since 2017. I mean, we cleared out the entire 2018 range. What's your thinking here on the 10-year yield?
Well, I do continue to think that what we're seeing are recession signals and weakening macro fundamentals and lots of reasons to think that this trend toward lower yields should continue in the long run. But you know, Patrick, we've had such a move from 2 spot 60 down to 2 spot 30. Just as I said, when we hit 2 spot 60, I said, folks, right here, this is it. Right now, this is your chance to buy the dip. I'd say right here at 230 is maybe time to take some profits if you followed that advice last time, because it feels to me like, you know, we're overdue for a pullback. I do think we'll probably get to lower yields eventually, but I won't be at all surprised if yields back up to 2 spot 50 over the next 2 or 3 months before moving decisively lower. We've already moved a little bit too far here. So I'd be inclined to take some profits and wait for another chance to buy the next dip.
Now, before we move on to the feature interview, please give us a quick update on your efforts to secure sponsorship for the new programming so that we can keep it free for our listeners.
Well, I'll try to keep this super short so we can get on to the feature interview. We're making progress, but we still need your help, folks, to achieve our goal of keeping Macro Voices content free for all of our listeners, for all of the content. So please think about whether your company, or for that matter, any other company where you have contacts in the marketing department, could benefit from sponsoring Macro Voices. We already have a few formative discussions with potential sponsors, but no solid deals as of yet. Sponsorship inquiries should be sent to my attention at info@macrovoices.com.
Well, thanks for the update, Eric. So now this week's featured interview guest is Invesco Chief Economist John Greenwood. Eric, why did we invite John onto the show this week?
Patrick, as a matter of policy, we generally don't go looking for guests based on their view. We try to seek out the smartest people and they say whatever it is that they have to say. Bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Well, what's happened is in the last several weeks, we've had so many bearish guests that quite a few listeners, for good reason, have said, hey, guys, come on, you got to balance this out. So I asked you, I said, Patrick, we got to do a better job as journalists here, even though you and I think that this is definitely late cycle dynamics, markets getting ready to roll over at some point. We got to get the other side represented. And I asked you to try to find the best guest that you could to represent the other side of the argument. So I'm going to turn the question around to you, Patrick. Why did you come up with John Greenwood in response to those criteria?
So Eric, I had the opportunity to meet John when he was a part of Russell Napier's program here in Toronto. And when John was teaching the part of the program on the business cycle, it immediately caught me. I mean, he was certainly talking that we're mid-cycle, but it was really the reasons behind why we were mid-cycle. You'll hear in a moment when John's explaining it, he's going to talk about the transmission mechanisms and how money growth plays an important role. And he asks those important questions as to, like, is it debt or is it money growth that really causes inflation, and inflation, how important it is to determining where we are in that cycle. So it was a really great story. He built a good argument why he feels that it's mid-cycle, and I wanted him to share it with our Macro Voice listeners.
Well, Patrick, I want to thank you for doing such a great job. I think John was exactly the right pick for these criteria. And although I still disagree with some of his conclusions in the end, this interview definitely opened my eye to several things that I hadn't really given adequate attention to. And we'll come back to some of those when we talk about this in postgame.
For sure. So Eric's interview with John Greenwood is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is John Greenwood, chief economist at Invesco. And listeners, John put together a fantastic chart book for us with some really excellent graphs and charts. I strongly encourage you to download the chart book. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com and look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads next to John's picture on our homepage. John, thanks so much for joining us. You know, we've had so many guests tell us that we are at the end of the business cycle, late cycle. And one of the reasons that Patrick, my producer, sought you out is because you are obviously a very credible voice, but one who does not think that we're necessarily at the end of the business cycle. So please tell us, where are we in the business cycle and what should we expect?
Sure. Well, my view is that broadly we're at mid-cycle, not late cycle. I know the cycle has been going on for 10 years almost. In fact, in June, will be the 10th anniversary of the trough of the last business cycle. So we've been expanding for 10 years. And in July, this current business cycle expansion will become the longest in recorded U.S. financial history. But nevertheless, I believe that it has several years to run. And basically, I think there are three reasons for that. First, money growth has been low and stable. Second, private sector leverage in the U.S. remains low, despite some concerns about the non-financial corporate sector. And thirdly, inflation is not a threat, nor do we face a major financial accident. Those are the two main causes why previous business cycles have come to a premature end. So in my view, if we take a historical analogy, we're at something like 1995 in the cycle that went from 1991 to 2001, which was the previous longest expansion cycle. So I think we have several years to go because the central bank, the Fed, doesn't have to take any drastic action at this point. And I don't believe that there are serious problems in the private sector that will cause a premature end to the expansion.
Let's go ahead and dive into your slide deck and talk about the mechanics of what actually drives the cycle.
Okay, well, if we look at this first graphic slide, it's a flow chart, which really sets out the phases and stages of a business cycle expansion. Now, it's important to understand that the business cycle, although there are arguments about this in academia, in my view, there's no doubt at all that the business cycle is fundamentally driven by money and credit. And while I've put monetary conditions in the slide here, what I really mean is the rate of growth of money and credit. So if we take an example, if the money growth rate accelerates from, say, 5% to 10%, it doubles from 5% to 10%, the first thing that will happen is that there will be an impact in the money markets and the asset prices. That's the second box in the flowchart. Now, this is what we call the portfolio rebalancing effect, because with more money than people want to hold in their portfolios, they are going to reallocate that money to other areas. Could be to money market securities, it could be to the bond market, it could be to equity market, could be to the housing market, or even commodities and other collectibles. But in any case, the first impact is generally on the asset market. And once asset prices have risen and people start feeling wealthier, two things will happen. First of all, businesses will start to hire more and invest more, and consumers will start to spend more. And both of those two things will drive up consumption and investment. So that will boost economic activity. And along with that, by the way, employment will rise and unemployment will fall. And then finally, now the fourth in the flowchart, the money growth rate continues to expand at a rapid rate, the 10% that I mentioned just now. Then after a lag of about 2 years, we will start to see that show up in consumer price inflation. So the entire business cycle, well, the business cycle covers pretty much everything, assets, economic activity to inflation, and the effect is built up and spread out over time. It doesn't kind of go immediately from excess money growth into economic activity or inflation. That process takes a while. And because it takes a while, a lot of people fail to kind of grasp or understand where we are in the process. So notice that I haven't talked about interest rates. They're not really a concern here. It's the quantity of money and quantity of credit which is driving the process. So how do we know that this is a reasonable description of how the process works? Well, if we go to the next slide, number three, this is a simple chart that shows the S&P 500, that's the black line, and the red line is the level of U.S. real GDP. And I've also put in the recession bars. And what you'll notice straight away is the way in which pretty much, well, in fact, in this slide, every single stock market peak precedes or comes very early start of a recession. So in other words, asset prices in the previous flow chart are going to peak before the economy peaks. That's what you'd expect from that flow diagram. And this is validating that. So if you want to understand what's going to happen in the stock market, I always say you've got to understand the business cycle that is driving it. If we go to the next slide, that's another illustration of the cycle. Only this time I've taken house prices instead of stock prices. And I've put the house prices this time in terms of rates of change because the US didn't have any significant downturns in house prices until this recent major downturn. But you can just as well look at cycles in terms of levels or rates of change. But if we look at this in terms of rates of change, we've got the rate of change of real GDP in black and the rate of change of house prices in red. And again, you see that pretty much all the house price peaks precede recessions. So again, asset prices peak before we hit recession. And then the third in this series, slide five, shows in the blue line capital values for the commercial real estate market. And once again, relative peaks in the commercial property market broadly precede any recession. So I think I've made the case fairly strongly there that asset prices are driven by the same sort of forces that drive the business cycle, which normally ends in a recession. And then on slide six, we have consumer prices. I've skipped one element, that is the GDP, because the GDP is the black line, which is shown in this chart, and the recessions are shown by the vertical bands. So we now move to slide six and inflation. Now, here you'll notice something different. Inflation tends to peak after the economy turns down and during or well into a recession. Another thing you will notice is that, and this is particularly clear in the 1980s and then in 1991, that there is a very wide gap between the inflation number and the GDP. In other words, the GDP turned down first, but inflation continues to rise for quite a while. That gives rise to the phenomenon we know as stagflation, that inflation tends to persist some considerable time after the economy has turned down. And this is a period historically when politicians and central bankers get very impatient with the economy being weak. They tend to put their foot on the gas. Danger is that in doing that, they will exacerbate the inflation even more. So to sum up, if we go to slide seven, we have the same flowchart at the top, but I've filled in the details of some of those boxes lower down. I see broad money accelerating in the first box and maintaining a faster rate for a sustained period. And then asset prices rising due to the portfolio rebalancing effect, and then economic activity turning up, reflected in stronger investment, stronger consumption, retail sales, employment, and of course, unemployment falling. And then finally, the outcome of this faster, sustained rate of rapid money growth would be higher inflation. As a digression, I may say at this point that many people put their trust in the Phillips curve. And I'd like to point out what is wrong with the Phillips curve. Many of you will know that the Phillips curve relates the level of unemployment on the horizontal axis or to the rate of change of wages or prices on the vertical axis. Because we've had very low unemployment recently, 3.7%, many economists at central banks, in academia, and indeed on Wall Street are saying that at some point that we must get inflation. But straight away, you can see what's wrong with that analysis. Essentially, what it's doing is ignoring those first two boxes and saying, forget about money. What it's doing is relating unemployment in the third box to prices in the fourth box. Now, it is true that in the past, strong money growth did produce strong employment and low unemployment, which did produce rising inflation. But that is not what we've had this time. So I've called this, if you look at the title more carefully, I've called this a type one business cycle, one that is generated by rapid money growth. But if we go to the next slide, here's type two, and this is what we've had this time. Because the private sector was so overleveraged in 2008-09, the demand for credit was very weak, and banks were risk averse. Consequently, instead of having rapid money growth, we've had very low money growth. And as a byproduct of that, interest rates have remained low. And in addition, asset prices have risen, yes, but mainly because interest rates have been low. That's what I call a capital markets effect rather than an effect of excess money. And then gradually the economy in the third box has improved. Investment has increased. Consumption has picked up. Retail sales, employment. And of course, we've got the lowest level of unemployment for 50 years. But because money growth has not been rapid, we have not had inflation. Inflation is broadly unchanged at somewhere between 1.5% and 2%. So you have to understand how strong the monetary forces are driving the business cycle. And in this cycle, they've been quite modest. We'll get into the details of that a little later on. But that's kind of an initial preliminary statement of the mechanics of the business cycle.
Let me just ask a couple of questions about that, because if I play devil's advocate here, the people who think that we're late cycle would look at what you've described and say, John, you know, you're exactly right. What happens is you tend to see asset prices peak well before we enter recession. We haven't re-entered recession officially yet, but that's coming. Look at the fact that Eurodollar futures or Eurodollar future spreads are basically discounting that most of the market thinks the Fed's next move will be to cut rather than to hike rates further. So the Fed seems to be done hiking, getting ready to cut. Doesn't that mean that we're approaching that point of the cycle ending? And it seems to me like the one very clear sign we've seen through these slides is we don't have inflation moving up dramatically, even as GDP is falling off. We don't have that signal. But it seems like the other signs of end of cycle are there, even as you've described this. What am I missing?
Well, the end of the business cycle is by no means automatic. It's going to be generated by a slowdown or a sharp slowdown in money and credit growth. And that's something we really haven't seen. We've had, as I shall show, low and stable money growth. And in addition, as I said at the beginning, the private sector is not leveraged up in any serious way, such as to threaten the business cycle. And inflation is low. So the central bank doesn't have a reason to squeeze from this point on. In fact, I would again make the analogy or parallel with the 1990s or indeed with the early 2000s. After the Fed had initially normalized rates in 1995, it then cut and raised and cut and raised it. So interest rates were varied quite a bit between 1995 and 2001. So just because the Fed has largely completed normalization, it doesn't mean that the rates will not change, and nor does it mean that, you know, rates are bound to fall because the economy goes into recession. GDP behaves in a fairly erratic way. At the moment, it's been, at least on the official numbers, been quite strong. And I doubt whether it will weaken very sharply, certainly not enough to be classified as a recession. So short-term variations in interest rates, a kind of fine-tuning of interest rates, is perfectly normal in the late stages, mid to late stages of a business cycle.
John, why don't we move on then? Because I know starting on slide 9, you've got a series of slides that talk about the role that debt plays in the business cycle. So let's bring that dimension in next, starting on slide 9.
Sure. I'd like to spend a few minutes on this because in talking to our clients and investors around the world, I find there's a huge degree of misunderstanding. many people are very worried about the high level of government debt or about debt in general. So if you look at slide 9, this is a kind of abbreviated monetary history of the United States since 1970. And what it shows is broad money. I've used M3 and an up-to-date proxy for M3 because the Fed stopped publishing it in 2005, I think it was, or 2006. And that's the dark blue line. And I've also got on this chart the ratio of government debt to GDP. I like to ask this question, which was responsible for inflation? Clearly, the 70s and early 80s were a period of high inflation, high and rising inflation in the US. And you can see from the chart, debt was low and fairly stable. Government debt was low and stable relative to GDP. But money growth was very rapid. Clearly, it was money growth behind the inflation. And then conversely, if we look at the recent period, you have very high government debt to GDP, nearly 100%. This is federal, state, and local government debt together as a percentage of GDP. But money growth, in contrast to the 70s and 80s, money growth is very low. And what do we have? We have low inflation. So I think it's clear from this that it is money that matters, not the level of debt. But another thing that people get hung up about is QE. For some reason, people think that money on the books of the central bank is somehow more important than money in the hands of the public, in the hands of households and firms. So if you go to slide 10, what I've done here is to index the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve System. That's the dark blue line, which I've labeled QE. And then I've indexed broad money and nominal GDP also to the same date. In this case, they're all indexed to January 2008 as 100. And I asked the question, so which is it is the driver of nominal GDP? Is it QE or is it broad money? And from the chart, it's obvious which is the driver. And you can apply this to other countries. If we go to slide 11, this is the same data for the UK. And again, it's clear that it's not QE, which is important for nominal GDP, it's broad money. If we go to slide 12 for Japan, it's clear that it's broad money that's important for nominal GDP. And that's total spending, not QE. Finally, for the Eurozone, it's exactly the same. It is broad money, in the Eurozone's case, M3, which has been the important driver of GDP, nominal GDP, not QE. So by way of sort of setting the scene, this is simply to say broad money is really what you need to monitor in getting that flow diagram for the business cycle correct going forward.
John, moving on to slide 14, why don't you tell me about money growth in various different countries and relate that to the concept that you just described to us?
Sure. Well, nominal GDP, of course, as everybody knows, is total nominal spending, current spending in dollars or yen or euros or renminbi or you name it, whatever currency. So it combines both real economic activity and goods and service price inflation, not asset prices. And what is very interesting is that broad money growth, in effect, acts as a kind of a ceiling to nominal spending growth or nominal GDP. So if we look at slide 14, and particularly the recent period since 2011 or 12, you can see that nominal GDP, which is the red line, has broadly remained below money growth, whether it's M2 or M3. Until just recently, when we've had a little bit of an uptick, which I think is the short-term reaction to the fiscal stimulus administered by President Trump. I personally don't believe that will last, but as long as money growth continues at this sort of 4-5% growth rate, then I don't think the US economy will come to any great harm. And this is something which is applicable right across the board. If we go now to slide 15, you can see exactly the same sort of relationship for the Eurozone. M3 in effect, creating a kind of ceiling for nominal GDP. There are occasional occasions when nominal GDP spikes up above money, but those episodes are relatively brief. And for the most part, for those of you who know the quantity theory of money and the fact that velocity is a declining number, those of you who understand that will know why this is. It's because money growth less a falling velocity gives you nominal GDP. Look also at the UK. Again, we have pretty much the same picture. Recent rates of growth of money are low and fairly stable. And although many people fear that sterling may fall sharply in the event of a hard or medium hard Brexit, in fact, the money growth rates have been so low as to call that into question. And then if we go to slide 17, you can see why Japan has had such a low inflation rate and a low nominal GDP growth rate ever since its bubble burst in 1991. Money, which during the bubble was growing at double digit rates, slumped. And since 1992, it's averaged only 2.6% per annum, which is much too low for Japan. And as a result, nominal GDP has averaged only 0.5% per annum with numerous episodes of deflation. So if Japan wants to end deflation or get the CPI up to 2%, it's going to need faster money growth. I calculate that Japan needs roughly 6% money growth, but you can see that it's never been near that in the past 25, nearly 30 years. And by the way, we can extend that in slide 18 to China, where we've recently had very slow money growth slowing from the mid-teens down to the high single digits, a rate of growth of money that we have not seen since China started its liberalization program in 1978. And then if you go to slide 19, the same applies in India. So right across the board, kind of like the law of gravity, it just applies, it applies in every country. Rates of broad money growth act as some kind of a ceiling for nominal spending growth in all these countries. And given that they are all experiencing rather low rates of money growth at the moment, to me, it seems inconceivable that the inflation rate is going to spike up anywhere. And therefore, there is no need for any of the central banks to suddenly slam their foot on the brake and raise interest rates and terminate the business cycle expansion.
John, as I look through these last several slides, you're talking about money supply as measured by M2 or M3. Those are measures of money supply in the banking system. What about the money in the shadow banking system? How does that play into this equation?
Yeah, well, that's very important, and I'm glad you raised that. If we go to slide 20, this is the measure of the shadow banking system in the U.S. that I use. In fact, you can measure shadow banking in two ways. One way is to add up the funding or the liability side of the balance sheet of the institutions involved in shadow banking. And that's what I've done here. I'll elaborate on that in just a moment. But the other way you can do it is to look at the instruments that are used in the shadow banking market. So things like repos, commercial paper, asset-backed securities, securitized debt, and so on, CLOs, CDOs, etc. Now, when people make payments, when firms and households and individuals make payments, they typically either write a check against a bank account or they make a payment digitally nowadays over the internet or however, drawn on accounts of commercial banks. So most of the GDP is reflected in those official sort of money numbers for the banking system. But the shadow banks have become very important in the asset markets. Now, in this particular chart, we have money market funds, which are essentially banks without capital. And then primary dealers, which were not banks. These were the investment banks before the crisis. Companies like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and others. But clearly, since the crisis, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs have applied to become banks, and they are part of the Federal Reserve System now. But they were creating credit prior to the 2008 crisis. And then we have the next group is the finance companies, mortgage finance companies, and auto finance companies like that, issuers of asset-backed securities, and then the notorious sieves and conduits, the funding corporations. That's the blue line. If you add those three, money market funds, primary dealer balance sheets, and the finance company line, you get the total of shadow banks. And what I want to draw to your attention is that at the peak, the size of shadow banks, the peak in 2008, shadow banks were $16 trillion. At the time, M2, money in the banking system, was only $8 trillion. In other words, the shadow banks were twice the size of the banks. Now, the Fed protected the banks, injected liquidity, and the Treasury did the TARP to recapitalize the banks. So the banks were, if you like, protected, recapitalized, and made healthy again, whereas the shadow banks, as you can see, contracted very sharply. What happened was when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, there was a universal realization that lending in these shadow banking markets, so buying the debt, whether it was the commercial paper issued by investment banks or by mortgage finance companies, this kind of paper was very unreliable, and the funding of these corporations, these shadow banks, evaporated. And as a result, as you can see, there was a very rapid shrinkage initially of these shadow banks, and they continued to shrink until about a year or so ago. And there's only been a very, very modest upturn since then. So in broad terms, shadow banks were very important, but they were important for the asset markets rather than for the regular goods and services. So if we go to the next slide, here what I've done is to show broad money growth again for the US. That light blue line is M2. But I've added in shadow banks. During the 1990s, that is during the tech bubble, you can see that credit was growing at 15 to 20% per annum. And similarly, during the housing bubble of the early 2000s, those are the two areas with the solid oval or circle. But since the Lehman bankruptcy in 2008, shadow banks contracted abruptly and have been shrinking at a very gradual rate since then, and only recently have just turned up a little bit. So what I've also done is to combine banks and shadow banks with that green line. So I took the total of the balance sheets of the banks, the M2 and the shadow bank liabilities, and that generates that green line. So whether you look at money in the banking, in the shadow banking system, the total has been growing at a very modest rate, only 4 to 5%. Now, people sometimes say to me, but surely there's very rapid growth in areas like leveraged loans. That is true. But leveraged loans are only at about $1.3, $1.4 trillion today. The banking system, as we just saw in the preceding slide, is close to $15 trillion. And the shadow banking system is altogether is about $10 trillion on this definition. So we're comparing very different sizes of entity here. The banks and shadow banks together are about $25 trillion. You take just one area of the shadow banking business, namely leveraged loans, that's only 1.5. It's not going to make a big difference to the overall U.S. economy or the asset markets.
John, moving on to slide 22, why don't we pull all of this together using the concepts that you've defined so far and just talk through where we stand in the business cycle and what comes next?
Sure. So slide 22 is a kind of simple outline of the business cycle in developed economies. And as you can see, I have allocate assets through the business cycle. And essentially, the business cycle is expanding through stages 1, 2, and 3. And then when monetary policy really tightens in phase 3, then obviously you need to shift towards cash. And as the economy heads towards a recession and rates start coming down, you can move into bonds. So this is a kind of asset allocation view of the same business cycle that we've been talking about. But to be specific, if we go to slide 23, there we have the US, which has largely normalized rates now in the middle of the phase 2. I guess you could argue with that and say possibly the US is closer to the end of phase 2 because the normalization is kind of at an end. But the important point is that the US has not moved to phase 3. That is where the Fed or the central bank is tightening deliberately in order to squeeze money and credit and to terminate the expansion in order to deal with inflation. That is definitively not today's problem. And then the UK is somewhat behind the US, only just started on the rate normalization process, and the EU, the Eurozone, and Japan are even further behind. They haven't even started to normalize. So that's a kind of very brief overview of the business cycle and where we stand, where the major countries stand. If you want to apply that to emerging economies, you can do so. But without going into too much detail here, the red line represents the business cycle of developed economies. The blue line represents the cycle of emerging market economies. And all I would say here is that the emerging economies tend to have a shorter, sharper cycle. So, for example, China, coming out of the 2008 downturn, put its foot hard on the accelerator. We had a very strong boom, but then they had to put their foot on the brake and things have slowed down. During the 1990s, Asia, many of the smaller economies in Asia, had no less than 3 boom-bust episodes of that kind in the space of a single U.S. business cycle expansion. So these short, sharp cycles are nothing new in the emerging markets, and they are still occurring.
John, you spoke earlier about leverage being an important aspect of this cycle. Please elaborate. I see on slide 25, it looks like we're illustrating this concept.
My slide 25 shows what I call 2 overlapping bell curves. The first curve, the red curve, shows what happens in a credit bubble to the private sector. This is a debt-to-income ratio, so it's a leverage ratio. And if monetary policy becomes excessively easy in the sense of rapid credit growth, rapid money growth, and lowish rates, low relative to nominal GDP, then you tend to get the private sector leveraging up, which is exactly what happened in the 90s and then again in the early 2000s. But when that leverage gets very high, one of 2 things can happen. Either the central bank can tighten, popping the bubble, or you can have a major financial accident. So that first black vertical line is essentially what has become known now as the Minsky moment. And after the Minsky moment, you have a radical change in behavior. All people want to deleverage because asset prices have fallen and they are overleveraged. So they hunker down, cut spending, cut investments. And if there are companies, they're going to cut spending and hiring until they have deleveraged. Meantime, governments, which abhor recessions, typically will come in with fiscal stimulus policies, but because their tax revenues have declined, they have to borrow to finance that. And so we typically see the public sector debt ratio rising. Now, things will go on like this until the private sector has deleveraged back to a level of households and companies feel that they can start to grow again. And only once that has happened can the public sector, the government sector, start to deleverage. Unfortunately, in Europe, they're doing it the other way around. They're emphasizing the need for public sector deleveraging. And as a result, the private sector is not getting any help in its deleveraging. But we'll come on to that. So that's the kind of theoretical concept. And I would say that no country has yet moved into phase 3, with every major country is still in phase 2. Now, if you go to slide 26 very quickly, here we see the data for the United States, the long buildup in private sector leverage from about 205% to 296% of GDP, and then the deleveraging which has occurred since then. Meantime, public sector has leveraged up, the government sector has leveraged up, and as I mentioned earlier, government debt to GDP ratio is around 100%. So the US is close to the end of phase two. I haven't yet drawn that second vertical line because interest rates are still very, very low. And it may be that as interest rates are raised further, if they are raised further, then there may be more deleveraging to come from the private sector. So that's where the US stands. The UK is, next slide, 27, is a little bit behind the US. It has deleveraged, but not as much. And these numbers are much higher for the UK because London is such a relative to the size of the UK economy. But contrast those two countries with Japan on slide 28, where the bubble burst as far back as the end of 1989, beginning of 1990. And look how little deleveraging there's been in Japan overall all these past 25, nearly 30 years. On the other hand, the public sector has continued to ramp up the debt ratio. But, of course, the inflation rate has remained very, very low. So with this high level of indebtedness, Japan has found it very difficult to grow, and banks have been risk-averse, reluctant to lend. And then finally, on slide 29, and I show you this after Japan, because in many ways, having leveraged up during the period to 2008, private sector, the red line, Europe basically failed to deleverage from 2009 to 2014-15. And their attitude was subprime. That's an American problem. Really did very little. But as I say, they are deleveraging or trying to get debt in the public sector down, which I believe is the wrong way around to do it. But I show you this because it seems to me to point to the risk that Europe is very likely to repeat this long period of very slow growth with near deflationary conditions that Japan has been through for the past 20 years or more. So in relation to debt generally, it's imperative after a credit crisis that balance sheets are repaired. The US and the UK, by and large, have done a good job in that. Japan was much slower, and the Eurozone is proving also very slow to do that. And as long as we have those very high debt ratios in Japan and the Eurozone, I think growth will tend to be subpar.
John, we're just about out of time, but please talk us through slide 30 before I let you go.
Sure. Well, this is a kind of a summary slide. What it shows you is broad money growth in all of the OECD countries. That's the black line. And inflation averaged across all those countries. These are weighted averages. And what you see is a simple explanation for why inflation has been so low in so many countries. Basically, we've had, since the crisis, much lower rates of growth of money and, incidentally, bank credit on the other side of bank balance sheets. And naturally, along with that, we've had very low rates of inflation. So until or unless we get faster rates of money and credit growth, to me, it's inconceivable that the inflation rate will pick up sharply. And therefore, there is no basis for to squeeze and terminate the cycle. Similarly, as I showed earlier, since leverage has come down, particularly in the US and the UK, there's no reason to expect a major financial accident. So for those reasons, I firmly believe that we are much closer to mid-cycle than late cycle.
Well, John, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Listeners, John is once again the chief economist for Invesco, I-N-V-E-S-C-O. So be sure to check out their website if you want to follow more of John's work. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have John on the show. You know, to me, it's so important to be able to look at the business cycle from a much bigger picture perspective to understand how important money supply and credit growth, which provides the money supply, is to determining where we are in the business cycles. And while I'm in the camp that we're late business cycle for sure, it's certainly really valuable to get some different perspectives on it.
Yeah, you know, if there's anything I've learned, Patrick, it's listening to people who you disagree with is more important in this game than listening to people you do agree with. You already know what you think. Having that confirmed by more people who just bolster your confidence at what could be an incorrect view doesn't help you. It's listening to the people who see it differently and looking for what they see that you don't see, that is where the opportunity is. And, you know, I still disagree about where we are, but one thing that really caught my attention in this interview was just the observation that usually when we see all these signals that we're seeing right now that says recession is coming, usually one of those is inflation is spiking, and that sets up the situation where, you know, the Fed can't really save the day and come to the rescue by accommodative policy, because if they were became too accommodative, it would exacerbate the inflation and their hands are tied. They're screwed. That's the situation they can't really get out of. Well, we don't have an inflation problem, which means the Fed can be accommodative and can rescue asset markets and keep things going. So considering that we don't have that inflation risk, it does change the dynamics from the norm somewhat. And that's an angle that I hadn't really given a lot of thought to before listening to this interview. All factors considered, I'm still of the opinion that we're at very late cycle. Recession is coming, but, you know, it's definitely eye-opening to think about the other side of the argument. In any event, Patrick, I want to move on to your chart book now. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. It says Postgame Chart Book. Or if you're not yet subscribed to Research Roundup, shame on you, you can find it by going to our homepage at macrovoices.com and look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads right next to John Greenwood's picture. Patrick, as I look at chart two, you know, when we spoke last week, it seemed like, wow, we're out of that green danger zone on that top green block you have. Must be headed higher. Maybe it's new all-time highs. And then, wow, after the last couple of days, we're right back into the danger zone. So what's coming next?
Right. So the theme for our chart book this week is really about commodities, but I just want to give everyone a quick update on the S&P chart. Now, our listeners probably all know that I'm short this market, but this is an incredibly important level where it's too early for the bears to make any victory laps. To me, this 2800 to 28 and a quarter level is really a line in the sand that if the bulls do a good job defending it, particularly on a second retest, that it could establish a correction bottom. You know, it's one of these typical corrections that last 3 weeks in duration, and then it could still reverse and bullishly advance. So this is still an incredibly important moment in the market. But to me, it's also, though, the levels below 2800, because once we get below 2800, there's going to be almost nothing stopping the market from a quick drop down to about the 27 and a quarter to 2750 area. But really, that's where a lot of more ominous liquidity events could occur that could accelerate the selling. So I want to sort of leave it at that bigger view that we're at an important pivot, a binary moment where either the bulls are going to hold the line or we could have some accelerated selling. So it's going to be a very interesting Friday and Monday price action in the next few days.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, the things to watch for here are going to be a daily close below 2800, and I'd say decisively below 2800 to really make it count. or a daily close above 28.75 or so, you know, going back to a new high above the recent cycle high a few weeks ago, that would be the indication that the bulls are winning. But you're right, we're right here in the danger zone. Let's move on to commodities, though, because, boy, we're seeing commodities in general are really not looking fantastic. And I think this fits in to our overall, you know, another sign of possible recession coming.
That's right. Now, what I particularly wanted to focus on in my mind on commodities is the impact commodity prices have on trends in inflation. Obviously, crude oil tends to have one of the largest impacts in that, but it's the entire commodity complex that's so important in inflation expectations. There have been a lot of people that have been really pushing this idea that the tariffs are going to create a transitory inflationary impulse as prices will rise from the tariffs. But, you know, one of the things that I think could offset those tariffs, it would be a potential rise in the dollar and subsequently further deterioration in commodities, because the disinflationary impulse from that trend could more than offset the impact of tariffs on China. And so which way these commodities go, I think is going to be incredibly important to that bigger theme. And so on page three, we have just that Bloomberg Commodity Index, which is the basket of all commodities. And this chart continues to look incredibly weak. A pattern of lower highs rolling over, making a little bit lower lows. It really just continues to support this idea that the path of least resistance in commodities continues to be decisively lower.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, if we look at oil futures on the next chart in a bigger view here, it's possible we're right on a key level here at the 100-day moving average in the continuation chart. If we somehow recover from this and don't move any lower than we went today, there's still room for this to be an intermediate bottom. But I think the more likely case is that we retrace at least part of this really, really big move that we had today. And then eventually, as the market kind of gathers more steam, moving up is just going to bring more sellers into the market. And I think we eventually could very easily be headed back into the 40s, if not all the way down to a retest of that Christmas low. Now, certainly, you can turn all of that around in an instant with the right geopolitical news. But just on economic news only, if there's no geopolitical upsets, I think that the stage is set to move considerably lower here. What are your thoughts?
You know, Eric, you're bang on. And this is why listening to the Energy Week podcast is so important, because the price action is one thing, but understanding the geopolitics that are emerging in the background that could drive the next trend move is just equally as important. You know, barring or without some geopolitical event spurring it higher, I do believe that the broader weakness in the commodity complex will drive crude oil weaker. And on my short-term targets are right around this 57.58, but like you were alluding to, if we see that failed rallies in the coming weeks, it's just going to solidify a potential new downtrend that could see weakness into the summer.
Patrick, moving on to slide five, we see RBOB gasoline rolling over, and it certainly led today's charge down, although it was interesting. Almost all day today, RBOB was leading the charge down, and towards the end of the day, it was WTI that actually made the final push lower. What do you see in terms of the outlook for gasoline?
Well, I think there's going to be that strong correlation between oil and gas, the way we've seen always throughout the last many years. But the one observation is that gasoline futures have really started to test those key highs from 2018. And I believe that it's pretty asymmetric at this moment. I don't see gasoline futures making multi-year highs. And so there's a lot of overhead resistance here and a lot of things that could cause this to mean revert back and down towards some of those lower levels. So at this stage, I don't see much upside here. Moving on to chart six here, Eric, what I wanted to touch on was copper. And particularly between chart six and seven is the divergence between copper and iron ore, which not always, but often have a correlation as basic material. And really what we've seen is copper rolling over, far more liquid future market, and it's weakening back down to 2018 lows, really kind of feeding this global economic slowdown. But there is literally no sign of iron ore stopping, or at least rolling over. And I don't know what to really make of this. Do you have any ideas as to why they are diverging this way?
You know, I have to be honest, Patrick, and say the best I can give you is a guess, because I really don't know. But the thing that hits my mind is just, who's the big consumer of iron ore? It's China. If China feels threatened by sanctions that could impede its ability to continue to import iron ore, a lot of it comes from Australia. You know, maybe that could continue to support a bid. But as you say, by the same argument, China's a major consumer of copper. We don't see copper catching a big bid here. So that's all that comes to mind. And it's a complete wild guess. I don't have an explanation for this.
Right. Well, I guess we'll just move on, because I really don't know what else to say about that. But when we get onto gold, which is on page 8, this is where it's interesting, because to me, gold has dug in and actually surprisingly held the line. It's certainly not anything bullish to say of the last couple of months, other than it's been relatively well defended. We haven't seen those drops of gold heading back down to 1200, which would have been something, if you look at most of the other commodity charts, something we would have anticipated gold to potentially be doing. Maybe there's a safe haven element to gold here.
Well, Patrick, I agree. My base case has been dollar moves considerably higher from here, and that's the reason that I think gold moves lower. Now, if I'm wrong about the dollar, I'm also wrong about gold. And as I look at this chart, again, trying to think about the other view, what if I'm wrong? Well, as much as it looks like we're now in a nice established downtrend, at the same time, yeah, it almost looks like a bull flag pattern that's forming on gold. And furthermore, if that were to reverse and we were to go above 1350, boy, doesn't that look like a great big cup and handle formation, which would project much higher numbers. So if I've got the dollar call wrong and we do get above 1350, then I think, you know, sky's the limit from there. But for now, my base case is that we break out of this descending wedge pattern to the downside. And, you know, there's an argument, a strong argument, that it could go the other way. If you just look at the shape on the chart pattern, a descending wedge like that would often break to the upside. But that's really going to be the next thing to watch for, is when that wedge pattern you can see on page 8 breaks, and you know, what comes next? Are we breaking up or down out of that pattern?
Right. And that's a really good point, because to me, it's the same thing. This looks like a consolidation wedge pattern that could very easily bullishly resolve itself. And I won't lie that I poked a couple of times on the upside of gold last week to try to see whether or not there was a breakout. But what I find troubling about that gold narrative of being on the short-term bullish, because I'm long-term bullish gold, just we're talking about the short-term trends, is the weakness that we're seeing in the other precious metals markets. On page 9, 10, and 11, I have the charts on silver, platinum, and palladium. And what we see here is that they are all very weak. Silver breaking to a multi-week fresh new low. Platinum prices going to retest the 2018 lows on the downside. And palladium, which was in a huge bull run going into the start of 2019, has really been just in full consolidation mode for the last several months. And so there isn't a lot of support from the other precious metals markets to suggest that somehow gold is ready to break out.
You make a really excellent point here, Patrick, and it's something that I've definitely learned, you know, going back to the oil market. If you're not really sure what to make of the WTI chart, look at the RBOB gasoline chart. It usually gives you clues to what's coming next for WTI. And I think likewise, you know, looking at what silver's doing, gold chart, that could be a bull flag pattern. It's getting ready to break much higher. But boy, silver sure doesn't look like it's getting ready to break higher. Platinum, no way. So I agree completely with what you've said here. Let's move on to wheat. What do you see there?
Well, I wanted to talk about the grains in general. So on pages 12, 13, and 14, I've got the charts on wheat, corn and soybean. Now, soybean on page 14 is obviously being impacted considerably from the tariffs and trade war, which continues to press it down near its 52-week lows. But what is interesting is that the flooding in the Midwest is creating all sorts of interesting scenarios for corn and wheat, rather than being correlated to the broader commodities at this stage, are really marching to the beat of their own drum due to the fundamentals of the conditions. And what's interesting, Karen Braun, who tweets on a lot of these grain things, put out a tweet that basically was showing the planting progress in the U.S. And as of May 19th, corn was at 49%, which was the slowest in record back to 1980. And so the rate of which they're able to plant here is not happening quickly. And when you go to spring wheat, it's at 70%, which is well below its average. And so you have a situation with those weather conditions are actually driving these prices on the short term. It'll be interesting to see how much farther they'll be able to push on that before they go back into correlation with a lot of the broader commodities.
Yeah, I know something that Pat Hemsworth mentioned on Energy Week this week is there is apparently, and I don't have the full details on this, there's some kind of decision that or a date that has been stipulated that's kind of like the line in the sand where you can't plant new corn after such and such a date. And I'm not clear if that's a regulatory thing or what, but I know that a lot of diesel traders are very concerned that there could be a major suppression in demand for diesel fuel if farmers in the Midwest are forced to abandon and not plant the corn that they had planned to plant. So I think that probably has something to do with that spike we see on page 13 in corn prices. Let's move on to lumber, which is usually a very good indicator of the broader economy because it has so much to do with construction costs.
Yeah, for sure. And lumber just continues to be weak. It's amazing that throughout the 2017 and the first half of 2018, there was an extraordinary bull market in lumber that essentially had it almost double in its price. But in the back half of 2018, we saw the bear market kind of rip lumber prices apart, almost halving the price. But we've seen now lumber for the last more or less 6 to 9 months trading right near its 52-week lows, and it continues to be under a lot of pressure. It'd be very interesting to see whether it breaks further or even if this just continues to be very weak, but there's certainly no immediate signs to show that there's recovery in the lumber markets.
Well, and if you go back to our earlier conversation about looking for clues by going to other markets, boy, if I look at lumber, you know, it seems like we're still above that late October low. So maybe it's bottoming here. Maybe this is the support level that's going to hold because it held back in November. And we've seen several other charts where what we're doing now is revisiting lows. But if we go right ahead to one more slide, page 16, cotton is a perfect example of something that got back to that late 2018 low and went right through it. And it says to me that maybe these other commodities, of course, that's a level that held before. There's going to be some support there, but it seems like the setup is to break through that support. We're seeing it with only a few commodities like cotton so far, but it makes me wonder when the next domino is going to fall.
No, that's for sure. Cotton breaking fresh new 52-week lows. And on charts 17 and 18, I also have sugar futures, which continue to trade right near the bottom end of their ranges, and coffee futures also making 52-week new lows on the downside. And so continued pressure right along the entire commodity complex. It was interesting, those that did subscribe to Variant Perceptions trial offer, they did have information on there talking about some of their leading indicators continuing to show further pressure in the coming 6 months on the commodity complex. So to me, this is a disinflationary pressure. I don't want to say deflationary because it's all, they got that boogeyman element to the word. But whenever commodity prices are down like this, and especially when, you know, the dollar is so strong, there really is, other than tariffs, there really isn't any storyline where you can build a case where inflation is going to rear its head.
Well, Patrick, it's very hard to call any of these things with certainty, but there's one call I can make out of this whole deck with absolute certainty, which is Saturday, June 1st, a week from Saturday, you will Absolutely, for sure. Be at the Westin Montreal, where you're speaking at Options Education Day for the Montreal Stock Exchange. Tell us a little bit more. It's only $50, which, again, is about the cost of a 12-pack in Western Canada. what can people expect there, and how do they sign up?
It's a great event held by the TMX. All sorts of great speakers coming out there, including myself, and a whole day of great options education. So I'm looking forward to meeting a lot of our listeners out there, and I'm looking forward to teaching them a few option strategies. It's going to be a great time.
And I want to remind our listeners, we do these post-game chart books with big picture trading chart books when time allows in the program. But Patrick does these webinars every single day of the week with updates on all of the markets. That is part of his subscription service, but you can get a free 14-day complimentary access. No credit card required. Just sign up and check out what it's about in order to get access to more of Patrick's daily commentary. You can contact them by emailing contact@bigpicturetrading.com or just visit the website, www.bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, we're going to need to leave it there. I do want to reiterate my request to listeners, please help us out with a favorable review on iTunes as we are working to secure sponsorship for the program to help keep it free for you, the listener. Boy, those reviews go a long way to help impress sponsors that are considering sponsoring us. So please help out if you possibly can by putting a review of Macro Voices on iTunes. And of course, don't forget to register your free account at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. The benefit is you'll receive our Research Roundup email. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
So this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to the chart book for John Greenwood's presentation, as well as the chart book we just discussed on commodities in the post game. There's also a link to the Market Huddle video where Kevin and I explain Charlie McElligott's gamma graphs and a Jeffrey Snyder article titled, What About Copper? So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, and myself, @PatrickSeresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Seresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.